Hey, you're listening to a song by Rostam, and maybe you're saying, hey, this isn't the way we usually start the show. Well, this is no usual show. We'll get to that, but you're listening to the Creative Pep Talk podcast. Whether you're building a creative career or just need to approach career in a creative way, we're here to help you chart your own path. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. Let's get into today's episode. Quick shout out to our sponsors. Study graphic design with Shillington for 3 months full-time or 9 months part-time. With Shillington's graphic design course, you'll graduate with a solid understanding of creative problem solving, design theory, and software. Create an incredible design portfolio and master how to discuss and sell your work. Essential skills for any creative career, as you know from this podcast. Learn more at shillo.design/pep. Shillo, shillo.design/pep. No matter what 2021 brings, you can spend it creating something meaningful with Skillshare's online classes because time is what we make of it. Time is what we make of it. It sounds very, take your life by its horns. By taking classes, damn it. Learn about illustration, design, photography, productivity, and more. With Skillshare's short classes, you can move your creative journey forward without putting your life on hold. Go check out this class, Self-Care Through Creativity, Turning Your Anxiety into Art. It's not all about making a career. Art is also just a tool in your toolbox for life. This is a class by Sarah Beth Morgan. Very interesting. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Go to Skillshare.com/creativepep for 2 free weeks. Skillshare.com/creativepep. Video is one of the most effective ways to stand out as a creator online these days. And with Storyblocks, I don't know what the inflection point of that. Of these days, Storyblocks, you can take your videos to the next level with affordable subscriptions, unlimited downloads, and 1 million royalty-free assets. You can level up. I'm going to do this maybe as Christopher Walken next time. Level up your content. That was my impression off the bat. What do you think? I got it for like 3 milliseconds. Storyblocks.com/creativepeptalk to learn more about how becoming Christopher Walken. Not really. Up your video game. Parents, are you a parent? I have a virtual event for kids coming up with Mightier centered around using art to support emotional well-being. Wait till the end of this episode to find out more or check out mightier.com/pizza for more info and to register today. Okay, today on the show, we have a creative hero of mine, Rostam. He's a musician. He was a co-founding member of Vampire Weekend. He's not in that band anymore, but I became a fan of Rostam when I was a huge fan of Vampire Weekend. After the third album, that album kind of like coincided with a lot of like existential stuff that I was working through and ended up being one of my all-time favorite albums. And I dove into, you know, who are these people making this work? And I found that so much of the things that I loved about the band were because of Rostam, who was a band member, the producer of all three of those albums. And the more I dug in and listened to his solo music and all the stuff he was producing and the artists that he has worked with, people like, I don't know, you might have heard of him, Claro, Charlie XCX, Haim, Carly Rae Jepsen, Frank Ocean, Solange Knowles. Like, if you are fans of these people, there's a big chance that part of why you're fans of them is Rostam's magic music touch. I was freaking out getting to have this conversation. It was one that I wanted to have for a long time. It absolutely will not disappoint. Rostam showed up so game to answer questions and get personal. And I was just thrilled because he exhibits so many of the qualities creatively that I aspire to embody in my own practice. So we'll get to that. By the way, Rostam has a new album out called Change Phobia. It's coming out in the next couple months. You can hear the new single Forerunner right now. We'll hit it up right now. And also, you know, where you get your music, go check it out. Huge, hugely excited to have Rostam on the show. Let's go.
And I feel part of me slide. When the trucks drive by, I feel I'm swayed side to side.
Well, thanks for doing this, man. I'm so thrilled to have a chance to chat with you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Are you, with all things considered, doing okay?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a very sad year. And at the same time, there's glimmers of hope. There have been nice things that have happened. But, you know.
Yeah.
Hopefully this year brings on change. Like big change in the coming years, and I guess I'm eternally an optimist, so that's what I can hope for and work towards and try to do things to work towards.
Yeah, me too. And I, you know, it's hard. I feel like in 2020, every good thing personally that happens, it's hard to even be happy about that because there's this other sense of guilt because of everything going on in the world. So it's hard. It's been a heck of a year for everybody, I think. And then especially for some people.
Yeah. I got the coronavirus.
You did?
Yeah, I got it in March. Well, I was in New York on the week of March 8th. I performed with Haim on Jimmy Fallon, and as I was flying back from the East Coast, I came down with a fever.
What?
And we were in New York on, that was kind of like the sort of like the ground zero week. And when I got home, my assistant came and picked me up from the airport. We went back to my house and I got in bed, and I stayed in bed, you know, and didn't see anyone for quite a while, but I had 4 days of fever. And then I came out of it and you know, I talked on the phone with my doctor, and he's like, yeah, you probably had COVID. If you were in New York, it's probably the case. And then a few weeks after that, I went and got tested for antibodies, and I tested positive for antibodies.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I haven't had it yet, but it sounded like your case wasn't too bad. You know, you had fever and all that, but you didn't have to be hospitalized or anything like that.
No, I was lucky. So I count my blessings there for sure.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I was really lucky, but yeah, it could have been way worse. So.
Well, I'm glad it wasn't. You know, I have to start this thing. I had the privilege to interview another one of my creative heroes, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, last year, and I'm going to have to start in a very similar way because you're in that stratosphere for me, and I don't have a chance of not fanboying to some degree. So when I interviewed him, I said, I'm going to get the Chris Farley Show stuff out from the start. We're just going to go through it real quick. Are you familiar with that skit where he's interviewing Paul McCartney and all of his heroes?
Yeah, I am familiar with that. Yeah.
So I'm not going to make you stay here very long, but I can't help but just be like, you remember in a river where you say hell yeah and it swells with the, like, I don't know if it's Irish or Scottish, like fiddle or violin, like that was awesome. Like I feel that, man. So and also Hannah Hunt, when the piano drops in, I'm like, I've listened to that thousands of times. So first of all, just say thank you for your music. It's a huge, huge thing for me. And it is a huge privilege to have you on the show.
Yeah, I'm ready to answer any questions you have about any song. And any album or anything that's touched you. I'm psyched to listen to what you have to say and to give some insight. If I can provide it, I'll be happy to provide some insight.
What I want to do is, I do want to kind of go into your story to how you get to doing the stuff you're doing now. But before we do, since you just did that great invitation, I do want to, let's just chat for a second about probably my two favorite moments. And you have to forgive me if I'm missing something that wasn't you, but my favorite Vampire Weekend song is Hannah Hunt. And that moment where the piano comes in is just like, I'm like, this is divine. I feel like I'm, you know, floating. Is that, this is the actual Chris Farley. It's like, was that, did you like that part? that's my favorite one. And I just is, you're on piano there, right?
Yes, that was, yes. I'm playing piano, some slide guitar, acoustic guitar, and organ. So I was doing a lot of stuff there. And that song was, it was something that Ezra had started. And I would say Ezra did the sort of traditional songwriting. Mm. And this dates back to sort of like, wow, it must have been, I feel like we worked on a version in 2010. So it was kicking around. Mm. And we tried, but you know what? I think we tried to play it even in a rehearsal back in like 08 or 07.
What?
Maybe even 06. So we tried to sort of perform it, and it didn't really come together back in the first Vampire Weekend album era. And then for Contra, we tried to make a version, and we actually started recording a version. And I've said this in interviews, but that version that we started kind of sounded like Nelly Furtado.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, it had a similar groove to Say It Right. And I had kind of sort of, I'd taken Ezra's piano chords, and I sort of put a passing chord in between every chord of his in the verses, and just kind of like, you know, I didn't revolutionize his chords, but I just sort of, I gave them a little bit of momentum so that it was moving sort of between two chords as opposed to vamping on one. And then I remember I remember the day that we kind of gave up on Hannah Hunt in 2009. And we both loved it. We both knew that there was something great there, but we just didn't see a way to finish it for that album. And there was 10 other songs to finish. So
what changed about the song? How did it end up on Modern Vampires?
So then I think, you know, like there was about a year period where Ezra and I would get together one-on-one about like 3 or 4 times a week. And we would just kind of like pass ideas back and forth. He would started stuff that we'd begin recording, and we'd begin the production phase, and I would start stuff, and he would come up with vocal parts for stuff I started, and we'd pass it back and forth. And, you know, we really started recording that album in my apartment in Dumbo. And Hannah Hunt was one of those ones. I remember like one day when we got together, he said, let's open that one up and like, or let's try that one from scratch. Let's see where we go. And I remember one of the things that I was really interested in at that time was this thing that happens where you have a Hammond organ, you have a piano playing these kind of pentatonic lines in octaves. I'm using some music jargon, but
we have lots of listeners that are musicians, and they'll get a kick out of it. So go as headlong into that as you want.
There are these classic songs like Bob Dylan songs or songs by the band, or even the band being Bob Dylan's backing band. Mm. And there's this thing that happens when the piano is playing and the organ is wailing away, and they're kind of doing different things. And there's this kind of feeling that you get from all those things happening together that I was like, we got to chase that feeling. That palette of sounds is what we should pursue on this. So that moment in Hannah Hunt was really about like just something very simple that you would hear in The Wait by the band. If you know that song, like take Take a Load Off Fanny. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that song, yeah. Right? But yeah, you might not think that that was an inspiration for Hannah Hunt, but it definitely was. And so was stuff like Queen Jane Approximately by Bob Dylan and Positively Fourth Street, or even Like a Rolling Stone. If you listen to those songs, there's that combination of sounds that it appealed to me, and I was, you know, deconstructing it and trying to reconstruct it in Hannah Hunt. So then I guess the part that comes after that was also kind of an important part of the song, just like where could the song go? And at that point, I think we'd recorded all the vocals for the song, except for we wondered about, like, should it go up an octave higher? And I asked Ezra, I was like, maybe you should try to sing that part an octave higher after the piano break. And he was kind of like, yeah, let me try it. And, you know, I don't think he'd never, like, really screamed like that on a Vampire Weekend song before. And we did a few takes of it, and it just kind of stuck. But I will say, like, that song, yeah, it was one that we wondered about because we had sort of tried and failed two times. And we were sort of nervous about, like, whether it could be, like, what we always wanted it to be. And I think ultimately it was.
In all honesty, it is one of my all-time favorite songs. And I, it's, you know, I've spent a lot of good time with it. And I hadn't really thought about how the vocal take is kind of uncharacteristic of Ezra in a way. I hadn't ever thought about the drama of that is a little bit outside of the sensibility of Vampire Weekend in a way. Do you feel like that?
I don't know, because I think, like, we'd worked on so much music over the years that, like, we knew all these different sides of ourselves, and we could kind of call upon them from each other when we were making records. So, you know, I remember the day after Bush got reelected, we made this kind of, like, angry punk song together that was called Four More Years. Right. And I'm pretty sure yeah, let's hope that doesn't happen again.
You can release that.
That is a good idea. But yeah, so, like, I'm pretty sure I remember Ezra singing kind of like that back on, you know, when we did that. This was back in college when we made that like kind of like somewhat tongue-in-cheek punk song. So yeah, I guess it was just kind of like, it was something that we knew could work. It was just about the, you know, making it happen.
I really appreciate you going into the weeds with that one. That is really cool for me. And but I want to talk about your creative journey. This podcast is mainly about, you know, dissecting creative journeys and seeing how people developed and all that kind of looking, you know, seeing patterns and all that. And one of the things we talk about a lot is just sensitivity and kind of what you were talking about when you're getting into the feeling of those particular songs and how, you know, these two instruments doing different things give this particular feeling and trying to recreate that and the mechanics of that. Like, that's very much like the stuff that we get into. And I wonder, just in terms of, like, origin story, what music really made you want to be a musician early on? Was it the typical kind of teenage year stuff, or whatever music is to you now, when did it become that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can definitely trace it back to an album called Octung Baby by U2 that came out in 1991. And I remember my brother had it on CD. And of course I wanted to be like my brother, but I was younger, 3.5 years younger. So I didn't have a CD player. I just had a cassette player. So I had Octung Baby on cassette because I wanted to listen to it. Yeah. And if ever, you know, if you know about U2 and their history and their trajectory, Octung Baby was a very different album for them. They had never sort of incorporated industrial music or loops or a sense of irony or a kind of darkness, a sort of humorous, macabre sense of darkness. Mm. And Octung Baby, which came out in 91, it saw U2 sort of do the hardest maneuver, which is to, like, get weirder and more anthemic at the same time. Mm. And I didn't hear that album that way. I've gone back and, you know, like, studied sort of the history and trajectory of U2, but I didn't get there like that. I was born in 83, so I would have been 8 years old when Achtung Baby came out. And it was the first album that kind of like I really experienced as an album. Prior to that, I had all these Beatles singles that my dad had, like CD singles of every single released by the Beatles. And I also had this very strange attraction to classical music, which, you know, I would sort of like wait till everyone had left the house and listen to Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture really loud as a kid and kind of soak that up. And I don't really know what brought me there. It was definitely a situation where like I told my parents that I wanted this CD and they were nice enough to take me to the store to get it. And they also love classical music, but there was some classical music that I just sort of had this really strange attraction to and was drawn to.
What, either with that or the Achtung Baby, what kind of feelings or emotions or things was it doing for you that was something you really wanted at the time?
Well, yeah, you know, I remember like if you know the photographer Anton Corbin, he took all these photos of them, and I think they lined them up in kind of like a grid, and they're these really high contrast, very like cool tones, and they're this kind of like mysterious. There's a quality of it that just felt a little bit mysterious and dangerous and endlessly fascinating and layered. There's so many layers in Achtung Baby, and I think that's part of what really drew me to it. And it, what's funny is the song that I remember like being the first one that really appealed to me was Wild Horses, which now when I listen to the album, I'm kind of like, oh, this song is the most throwaway. If you had to get rid of one, I hope it's this one. But that was also the song that sort of made me want to listen to the album and made me sort of addicted to the album in the way that I've become addicted to other albums, you know, over my lifetime. But I think that was the first album that I kind of fell for in that way.
But I thought it was interesting that to you, the listening experience was so synonymous that there's some kind of like, you know, blendy synesthesia thing between the music impact and the visual impact. And I think probably a lot of people don't know this, but did you design all of the Vampire Weekend record covers?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think on the second and the third albums, what was unique about what I did was I found those photos.
Right.
And on the first one, that photo was actually taken at a show that we played in college, and it was a Polaroid, and Ezra was like, oh, I think this could be the cover. And that was just a matter of sort of like laying out the text. Whereas on the second and the third album, those were photos that I found on the internet. So in addition to like the text and the layout, it was about like finding those pictures. And yes, I think that for me, music and the visual world are completely connected. I think when I'm listening to sound, I'm often seeing things. I don't know how to describe it. I don't have synesthesia in the way that I've heard people describe synesthesia. I have been asked by many people if I am synesthetic, but I'm not. I will say that for me, they're just deeply linked, and I can't unlink them. And I think a great recording is one that has a lot of colors in it. And I don't know how else to describe it. That's my goal as a producer whenever I'm working on music, is whenever I'm working on a recording, is just like, let's make sure the colors, whatever the color palette is there, like let's make sure that it's right, and that make sure nothing dulls down these colors, which I think can happen very easily. Like you'll have a song and you'll work on it for a few hours and bounce it down and listen to it in your car or on your headphones or wherever you listen to music outside of the studio. And it'll have there's something about the combination of the sounds that it paints a picture mentally. And then it's easy to lose that sometimes. And all of a sudden, like everything becomes the same color. And you're like, whoa, why did that happen? What happened? How do we fix it? How do we keep the colors alive? And so that's oftentimes why I think it can take me a long time to finish things, or I'll spend a lot of time at the final stages kind of going back and forth to make sure that something is as good as it can be. Because to me, it is very visual.
Yeah, man. I love that. This idea of, you know, the saturation and the contrast of the sound, just, you know, visually feeling right. And we talk about on the show all the time. I often, when I go to make an illustration, will make a playlist and be like, I want my illustration to sound like that. And there's some weird thing that you get from kind of thinking about it in an abstract way. For whatever reason, that helps me get in there. And it reminds me of, I've heard Solange will do massive mood boards and mood videos and really get all the visuals right even before they're making music. Does that ring a bell? Is that kind of right in your mind?
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody has to have like a concept when they go into making something, whether it's a song or an album. And I think if the concept is purely musical, then the music is kind of bland. It's about integrating or I wouldn't even say the music. I would say that the end product is kind of bland. I think it's often times like the best stuff is about integrating the visual world, the written word with music, whether it's, yeah, paintings or art or films or books or even just, you know, inspirations, attitudes, people, you know, people that are inspiring. Like, I think that's like the best stuff sort of is inspired by more than just music. The best music is inspired by more than just music, I think, for sure.
Yeah, I've never thought about the inspiration of a person, but that's totally true. There's also this element of like some of my best things are things where I've almost made them like a gift to a friend because I understand their sensibility that overlaps in mine. And in that way, I'm inspired to kind of meet them there and I'm excited to send them something. And there's some, all these tools are like things to get out of the limited perspective of the blank page with the medium you're using. Like, I don't know. It seems like to break you out and open it up or something.
Yeah, for sure. I think you're right.
So you majored in music, right? In Columbia?
Yeah, I did.
Was that a difficult choice to major in music? Did you know going in that you were going to do that? And did you feel like sure about that? Was that scary?
It wasn't scary. It was what I knew that I wanted to study arriving there as a freshman. I was also interested in math, which I'm still interested in, but in a different, I mean, not, I didn't study math in the way that I studied music there. And I thought I might be a composer, either a film composer or a composer of classical music, or, you know, as it, I came to understand it, university music, because the people that write that kind of music, they do it for universities, in universities. And I guess I found that it felt like sort of limiting to make music that wouldn't be heard by everyone. And I think there was a part of me that was interested in trying to push the game forward in a universal way, like in the sense of like to try to make music that was game changing, but that everybody could hear. And that's still kind of been my motive in making music. I want to make music that's like as complex as possible on some level, but also that has mass appeal, because I think it's more enticing, I guess.
That is really fascinating. It kind of feels like there's a breaking down of the dualism of the stuff you were doing that you were listening to as a kid, when you're listening to the classical stuff and then you're listening to U2. It's almost like, you know, those two things exist both within your taste and point of view and sensibility. Is that what you're kind of saying? Is you're trying to create from both of those places in a combinatorial kind of way?
Yeah, I think so. And yeah, not, I wouldn't just say classical music is like the only sort of complex music that I was intrigued by, because I was also intrigued by jazz as a kid and like stuff like Jimi Hendrix and stuff like Persian music that my parents had around the house. I guess what it is like, yeah, the most sort of intricate and elaborate and naughty music, like K-N-O-T-T-Y. Like there's something about that music, or even like, I remember when I started to get into Timbaland and his productions and his like sense of rhythm and drum programming, like it just felt like, oh, like this is what we should aspire to. This is what I should aspire to, is to make music that pushes boundaries, but you know, that can also be on MTV, which, yeah, you know, MTV isn't anything anymore, but on when we were kids, I don't know how old you are, Andy, but I'm 36
34,
now.
So I remember music on music TV. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to remember that.
Yeah. So MTV was just like, you know, in some ways that was kind of like a loading dock or like a meeting place for all different kinds of music. And yeah, it seemed like a challenge. Like, what's the most complex music you could get on MTV?
Yeah, man, that's so interesting. And, you know, without really putting any hierarchy to it, it kind of reminds me of, to look at it from a different medium again, it kind of reminds me of like what a chef will do, you know, when they come from the South and they grew up eating biscuits and gravy, or they grew up eating, I don't know, Cajun food or whatever. And then they go move to a city where they're tasting fine dining, and there's some kind of, you know, how do I fuse those things or elevate this portion, or, you know, that's what it kind of reminds me of. Does that feel right?
Yes. And it's interesting that you bring this up. I don't know if you know this, but my mom is a cookbook author and chef. And so
I didn't know that. No.
Yes. So I grew up, basically at any given moment, I was tasting a recipe that my mom was perfecting, and I was helping her in the kitchen. I was learning about cooking through osmosis, just being around her. And so I very much grew up in a chef's household, in a chef's kitchen, surrounded by, like, you know, constant fine tuning and tweaking. And so, yes, I think that food and music are very, very much, they're analogs, and they're very connected, and there's threads that connect them. Like, you know, like when you're balancing a mix, just like when you're putting salt on French fries, you know, if you put too much salt on French fries, you can't eat them. Yeah. And if you don't put any salt on French fries, you know, you did.
You don't want to. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to eat them. You want a little, you want the right amount. And I think that can often be a huge part of music. And I think it's certainly something that is super important to me, is to have mixes that sound balanced and that are fun to listen to. Like, there's definitely music that I hear that's being made in the world and released, and I'm just like, there's things about it I like, but I don't think it's fun to listen to because, like, it hurts your ears. You know, yeah. That's like a real, very real thing for me. And it's something that I care a lot about.
It makes so much sense. What I love about the creativity of food is it's so practical that it has this kind of humility. I love this idea of, like, there's this understood thing in recipes. I mean, you know better than me, but I've heard that, you know, in order for it to be your recipe, it's got to have three differences from the recipe that you learn from, or from the recipes you learn from. And I think that, you know, I feel like I hear that kind of groundedness. And whenever you talk about music, like, you know, I'll hear you talk about on Song Exploder, talking about Coldplay, and, you know, 2 seconds later, you're talking about some challenging thing that's really complicated. And, you know, I just feel there's something about that approach to creativity through food that never loses sight of the fact that this is for people's consumption. Like, you know, and it sounds like that mentality rubbed off on you in some way.
Yeah, definitely. I think my parents were special because they took me and my brother to see a lot of art when we were kids, and we were constantly in museums, and we were constantly being exposed to these kind of monumental pieces. And because we grew up in DC, that was really heightened too, because there's so much art to see in DC. So yeah, I think you're right. Like, there's something that's appealing about trying to make art that everybody can experience. That's definitely something that I think about all the time. And I think that the song is this interesting unit in which it's kind of like, it's my chosen unit for art. Cause I knew as a kid that I wanted to make art. And for a long time, I thought I might actually be a painter, draw comic books. That was a really big part of my life for many years. And
really,
I also wanted to design cars, and there's a part of me that still wants to design cars. It's not something I talk about a lot. And we can get into that stuff if you're curious, if you want me to talk about it. But
I am.
But I guess I look at like the song as that place, that 3.5 minute or 4.5 minute sort of place where I can put all my creativity into and feel really fulfilled. That's I feel really when a song comes out right, I feel like really artistically fulfilled in a way that I think I don't know that I could feel the same way about a painting, even though I spent, you know, 3 or 4 hours every day drawing when I was a kid. That sort of tapered off and music took its place.
You still think about designing cars too?
I do. And I think it's very similar because it's like, it's to me that car design, it's like this sculpture that is roaming the streets. And a really beautifully designed car is like, it's like an amazing song that everybody can experience, you know, like anyone can experience a beautifully designed car on the street. It can just be driving by and it can make you feel something. Now I know that everybody doesn't feel that way about cars. Like people don't get like, you know, turned on by cars the way I do. I literally can like feel the hairs on the back of my neck rise when like certain cars drive by in the street. I know that everybody doesn't feel that way. I think more people probably feel that way about music and songs.
Yeah. That's a more common sensitivity. But, you know, it's interesting just being in tune to that sensitivity is so, for me, that's so much about everything is led through that lens of what are the things I'm hypersensitive to that other people aren't. So maybe you know, you're an amazing musician. I'm glad you picked that path, but man, what kind of cars could you have brought with that sensitivity? I'll always be wondering, maybe there's a second act for your car design career. And actually, I wish that the slickness of cars, I sometimes feel like they're just like so worn and that we don't have angles anymore. And like, we need somebody to get in there and bring some of that.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that's interesting about car design is that, so our car's life cycle lasts about 6 years. And in addition to that, it takes, you know, 7 or 8 years to put the car in production. So when you add that up, somebody who's designing a car right now has to think about a design that will still be relevant 14 years from now.
That is crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like, it's like, imagine if I had to make like songs that couldn't come out for 7 years, and I'd have to like make sure that the song still, you know, was relevant to what was on the radio 7 years from its release. That would be totally crazy, but as I'm saying it, that does seem like a fun challenge.
I was going to say, this is a creative prompt. Like, go make a song that you're like, this is going to be released 7 years from now, and it's going to be played on the radio for 7 years. And that's what would I make and how would that sound? Like, that is, I'm very interested in that. I might be drawing some things in that vein.
That does remind me of like when me and Wes were making the Discovery album, I was very concerned with futurism. I was like, I want it to sound futuristic. Like, what can we do to make everything sound futuristic? Like, what's the most futuristic? Like, if there is anything that sounded vaguely futuristic in a song that we liked, I was like, let's just take that and push it to the limit. Let's try to make it as futuristic as it could possibly sound. So
that's awesome. And that makes sense from that album. I think it totally reads. I love when sponsors reach out to sponsor the show, and I already know and I'm already fans of their brand and company. Shillington is an example of that. I had a friend teach there, and he told me, like, this is a rigorous practice that really creates graphic designers at the end of the program, and they do it ultra quick. Don't believe me. You don't have to take my word for it. Listen to Sophia, who said, a family friend told me about Shillington and it seemed like a great fit as you learned the Adobe Big Three, InDesign, Illustrator, and Photoshop, which I realized were skills I needed to learn. Hearing how career-focused the course was, that I'm a huge fan of that, was really stood out from the other ones I looked at. I love that Shillington gave me the technical skills I need while also teaching me how to be a designer in 2021. Love it. Shillington, shillo.design/pep. Go check it out. shillo.design/pep. Huge shout out to Skillshare. Skillshare has a class out there right now called Self-Care Through Creativity, Turn Your Anxiety into Art by Sarah Beth Morgan. I'm a big believer that your art needs to be personal before it's public. And if you have forgotten how to use art to connect to yourself in a deeper way, I think this class is a good idea. There's even an insightful interview with a real deal art therapist in this class. Helpful tips for setting up a safe space to explore your emotions through your art. And three actionable art therapy exercises to pull inspiration from your mental health or what you're actually going through. Very, very cool. The class is really well done. Sarah Beth Morgan, go check it out. Skillshare.com/creativepep for 2 free weeks. Skillshare.com/creativepep. Storyblocks has a bunch, like over a million royalty-free assets, video, sound effects, audio. We use some of the audio on this show and some sound effects on the show. If you want to level up your creative content game, this is a great way to do it. They have tons of really good stuff on there. You can do creative things with it. I've seen people use stock video creatively with their animations and level it up that way. Very cool. Storyblocks are a great company. Storyblocks.com/creativepeptalk to find out more. All right, I'm going to rewind and go back a little bit to the thread, although I feel like I could keep talking about car design, but, you know, fans of yours, I'm not sure they came for that, but it's what we got, and I was feeling it.
I need to bring in my new wave of car fans, but yeah, I agree. Let's talk about music.
So you go to Columbia, and that's, you know, famously where Vampire Weekend is formed, as far as I know, and I wonder, you know, when there's a collaborative thing happening like that and pieces come together, when I'm forming partnerships creatively, I think I'm always kind of aware of what the other people are bringing to the table that, at least at the time, I don't have. And I wonder what those pieces were for Vampire Weekend, and maybe even specifically Ezra. What was exciting about that to you of, you know, this give and take thing?
I think we, throughout college, Ezra and I met freshman year of college, and throughout college, we worked on these different projects in different capacities together. And in some ways, Vampire Weekend was the culmination of that. It was a live band, which we kind of hadn't done before. Or we sort of tried it back in when we were sophomores, and just it didn't really take. And then it was, you know, senior year, it was us kind of retrying that. And so it had that live component, and then it also had the recording component. And, you know, we had worked on recordings together throughout college. And pretty much as soon as Vampire Weekend started, we also started recording our songs, and those recordings that we were making, those recordings that I was producing, that is what became our first album. And, you know, even before we graduated from college, we had started Oxford Comma, we had started Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa, we had started Walcott, and elements of those recordings were done, you know, on campus. And as we continued to finish those songs, you know, that that's what became the first Vampire Weekend album. So, yeah, it was this kind of combination of, you know, like the live component, which was felt very new. The fact that we could play songs for friends at these kind of like literary societies, which were, I don't want to say they were frat houses. I mean, maybe technically they were, but it was more kind of like they were. It was more co-ed. It was like we were playing the quote unquote the queer frat. It was those. That was some of my favorite shows were when we were playing in these old houses that had just kind of like it wasn't really a concert venue. It was almost like a dance hall in the 50s sense of the word. And it'd be like a townhouse on the second floor. And we'd be just like, you know, playing for a crowd of people that was jumping up and down and the whole floor was shaking. But let me answer your question. So, yeah.
I'm lost in all this. I'm thinking, are there recordings of any of that stuff?
Yeah, there are some, actually. I think if you search ADP, you might be able to find some old recordings of that stuff. But yeah, I think Ezra was someone that I knew from, you know, from the first time that we kind of sent each other music. I knew that he was someone who was an amazing songwriter off the bat. And I think I was getting better and better at recording music and writing music. And I actually don't think I was good at doing those things when I started school. I had a lot of like desire to write great music, but I wasn't really that good at it. And I had to fail. And I think I remember this moment. I don't want to say I wasn't good at it. I remember this moment. Well, yeah, I actually do want to say I wasn't good at it. If you're listening to this podcast right now and you make music and you're not happy with what you make, guess what? That's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's good to not be happy with what you make because that really means that you care and that you want to find that thing that does make you happy in your own work. And I think you got to struggle. You got to fail. Everybody talks about this. But throughout college, I think I was getting better and better at making recordings, at doing things like writing string arrangements and, you know, production, like drum sounds, guitar sounds, vocals, all these things. Throughout college, I was sort of on this journey on my own and getting better and better at doing those things. And at the same time, I was studying classical music. So I was learning how to write for violin and viola and cello. I was learning how to write for orchestra. So I was just gaining these necessary sort of like knowledge bases. And when our senior year came, we had this kind of culmination where the songwriting side was really fueled by Ezra and the recording side was fueled by me. And of course we had overlap in different ways, but then having Chris and Chris, who we knew from campus and we'd worked with in different capacities as well, like sort of the four of us kind of like built off of one another. And it just sort of had its natural momentum on a few different fronts. Like I was saying, there's the recording side and also the live performance side.
Mm. I want to just highlight something you said that I think is really interesting. Like this idea that part of, you know, one of the tools in your tool belt is that metal detector taste thing that is telling you it's not good. Like this idea of like, if you're unhappy with what you're creating, that means that there's some internal mechanism that will help you hit that target because you can see the gap. Do you know what is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And it's funny, like I feel like people who are too happy with what they make, oftentimes they don't ultimately, even if they might be happy in the moment, but it's the people who are sort of obsessed with finding every crevice that's, you know, the spaces that could be filled, that could be made better. It's that striving for more that results, I think, in really amazing, you know, creative work.
It's interesting, this you know, it's almost like you're looking for something particular. Like, you know, it's almost like a weird search, as and you've kind of described that a few different times, of what it is you're trying to achieve in these things. And early on, you're like, this is not it at all. I'm not doing it. Yeah, that's super interesting. And, you know, at the time, it seems like, from what I know about your story, you were also not comfortable being the lead man on the project. Is that right?
I will say this. From the time that I was 14, I knew I wanted to be a record producer.
Okay.
I knew that I wanted to produce records, and I loved songwriting, and I think I was like kind of figuring out it took me longer to sort of figure out what I wanted to say as a songwriter. I'd say in the early days, back when I was in college, there was one song that I wrote pretty much on my own that I was proud of, and that was Campus, that became a Vampire Weekend song. But it started just as a song that I wrote kind of on acoustic guitar, almost like, if you can imagine it, finger picked acoustic guitar. And then it became a song on that I sort of orchestrated and started recording with strings, and then it became a Vampire Weekend song that Ezra sang. But I would say, like, I think it just, you're right that I wasn't exactly sure about what I wanted to say in terms of a songwriting voice. I did have more concrete ideas about what I wanted to say as a composer or as a producer. And I think it took me time throughout my 20s to kind of figure out what I wanted to say as a songwriter. Although I was doing it, I was constantly doing it, but it was harder for me to have like that clear vision of what I wanted to say songwriting wise. But I was doing it, and at times, like songs like Campus or Diplomat's Son, my songwriting voice was kind of coming out in Vampire Weekend, and also in Discovery, my songwriting voice was definitely coming out on about half of those songs. But yeah, I would say, like, I don't think I had a problem so much with the positioning of being a lead singer. It was more kind of like what I wanted to say that felt more important. And I wasn't quite sure yet how I wanted to say it or what exactly I wanted to say.
That's fascinating. I was actually just going to ask you about Diplomat's Son, because I remember my little brother and I are huge fans, and we both like freaked out about that song. And that's, I think, where we started pulling the thread and got to know more your part in the and all the other things you're doing. And I'm curious about how, if people don't know, is this the first Vampire Weekend song that you sang vocals on? You're at towards the end.
Yes.
Or somewhere in the middle, I guess. But is that the first one?
Yeah, I mean, I sang vocal harmonies on almost all the songs that have vocal harmonies. But yeah, this was the first one that I take the lead for a section of the song. And it was a song that, like I was saying, like to me, that there was the production side and the composition side. I immediately had this very concrete idea where I wanted to take these two reggae feelings, like grooves, the bum cha 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 cha, and also the bum ba bum bum ba bum bum ba bum. And they're two very different feelings, and they're actually different tempos too. And I had this idea, like, yeah, so the second one is much slower than the first one. I was like, what would it be like to make a song that jams these two things together? But then also on the other side, like we were just talking about, like the songwriting voice, I was like, what about telling a story that is uniquely a same-sex romance? And is there a way to do that sort of in the Vampire Weekend context? And can it also like be this sort of political move, in the sense that, you know, there is a tradition in reggae music, or more specifically dancehall music, of being homophobic. Hmm. And, you know, if you've heard, you know, if you've heard the butty man or butty boy, it's like these are slurs against gay people. Mm. But instead of trying to criticize like another culture, I just found it much more sort of subversive to synthesize something and put sort of like this queer love story inside of a dancehall setting or a reggae setting and then let that speak for itself. I've actually never talked about this in
this
such
is great.
Explicit.
I'm yeah. loving this is so fascinating.
Yeah, I haven't talked about this explicitly because, you know, I guess it's been 11 years since we wrote that song. It's been 11 years since that song came out. But to me, there's something fascinating about, you know, maybe now it's okay to talk about, but at the time I found it much more powerful to let it speak for itself.
Wow. All right. Well, thanks for sharing that. And I'm wondering how this tracks to, that's in, I think, 2010. And then all the way, I think around then you released a single, but it was much later, like 2016 or something, where you released Bike Dream, which is taking some of that stuff and that personal, it seemed like personal development and what you want to say, it tracks with creative development, right? Like they go hand in hand. And it seems like Bike Dream was an extension of some of that. Is that correct?
Yeah. No, it definitely. I think I was thinking about like coming out, what that meant. And I was thinking about, you know, the word discreetly is even in Bike Dream. So I was thinking about like what it means to be with somebody discreetly and what it means to want that or to need that. And if that's healthy or not healthy. And, you know, I was definitely thinking about shame and sort of wanting to eradicate shame from my consciousness. And maybe, you know, maybe not fully explicitly, but those things were on my mind.
Can you just, I want to dive deeper into the that song. For people that maybe aren't familiar, can you just talk a little bit about Bike Dream? And this is one of the big songs on your solo release. And it's a fantastic song. Highly recommend people go listen to it. I've listened to it 3 million times.
Thank you, Eddie.
But can you talk about a little bit about the idea of that song and what you were exploring? Because I'm just interested in, you know, it seems to be a pattern of creative breakthrough goes hand in hand often with personal breakthrough and personal journey. And it seems like that's kind of what was happening for you.
I think, yeah, just to sum up to give people a sense of what Bike Dream is about, it's a love song that is also sort of asking questions about some of the things that I just mentioned about like discretion and shame and like, you know, what do you want from somebody that you love? And the chorus goes, two boys, one to love you sweetly, one does so discreetly, never will he meet me. So it's like the two boys are not, in fact, two different people. It's more of asking a question of like, what kind of boyfriend do you want? And why do you want that discreet boyfriend? So it's kind of self-reflective in that sense. Some people have thought it was about a throuple, but it's not. Right. I can clarify on this podcast.
It can be read that way. I could see that. but I feel like I heard you say at some point something about whether you did you consider masking the same sex thing at some point, or you approached it in a way that was still discreet and lyrically, or this was, you know, I think Diplomat's Son was less overt. Like, I feel like you have to kind of listen to the lyrics to hear what's going on there, but this felt more like a coming out kind of song. Is that right?
Yeah. The chorus opens up with the words two boys. So it's like inherently like already we're in a queer space. But I will say something fascinating is that Lennon Stella, I don't know if you know who that is. She was on the show Nashville. She plays Connie Britton's daughter on that show. And she subsequently become a pop star. But as she was rising to pop stardom, she did a cover of the chorus of Bike Dream on acoustic guitar. Hmm. and it works so well, and it doesn't feel strange to hear her sing that. And I think that that's kind of a testament to what I was going for, which was to create a song that could slip through the masses, that could work as a song sung by a woman, and it could work sung by anyone, really. And I guess, yeah, I guess, like, to me, that has felt important in making queer art on some level. Like, it feels like that's the challenge, is to try to make something that, like we talked about earlier, that anybody could love, whether they identify as queer, whether they're not ready to identify as queer, or, you know, whether they think they hate queer people, or they hate gay people, or they hate lesbians, or they hate people who identify as non-binary. Like, whatever it is, can you reach those people and you know, hook them, and then pull the rug out from under them?
Yeah.
Make people see things from a different side. That's kind of like, that's what we're trying to do sometimes.
You wake up late, you feel your heart begin to work, and now you're all dressed up, of course, inhaling cabs out of your door. On 14th Street, I feel my head between my knees, an orange swirling through the cheese, an orange swirling through the cheese. Where could I go? What could I do? Put in the state my lips and eyes.
And there's an empathy, too, of, like, anyone listening to that song can relate to the romance story of them, regardless of gender and sexuality and whatever. And I think, I'm glad you brought it back to some of the earlier stuff we were talking about, because I wanted to think about how, you know, the stuff that you got from U2 back in the day, whatever that was doing for you and doing for your soul and doing for you as wanting to be a musician, mixed with what you grew into wanting to say. I'm just curious of, you know, what my listeners are sick of me saying this, but it's something I think about all the time in creativity. There's a Gary Shandling quote of giving what you didn't get. And I just wonder, you know, do you ever think about creating music that would have hit Rostam growing up even more than you two, because you're telling stories that you could relate to more, you know, directly? Or, you know, or what do you want to do in music? You mentioned on the creative side, like, getting complex stuff to be accessible. That's one thing that you're giving that you maybe didn't get so much, but yeah, I don't know if you can speak to that. Just like, what are you, with your drop into the creative ocean, what are you trying to put in there that maybe isn't there yet?
Yeah, I think that you make a really great point, which is, going into making music, it's important to have some kind of greater goal, I think, or going into creating anything. And yet you cannot be defined by that goal. If, you know, if all you care about is making something that satisfies your initial desire, usually the sort of end product is just that. It's just dissatisfying that desire, and it's not something greater. So, yeah, I think you make a great point. Like, you got to try to make the music that you want to hear in the world that you feel like is missing. And at the same time, you got to let yourself get a little bit lost in the process and let it take you where it takes you. Like, I don't know if you ever do this, Andy, but when you sit down in front of a sketch pad or an iPad or a Wacom tablet, if you just let yourself draw and not think consciously about where it's ending up, like, where are you going? Like, that's important, because the creative process, I think, should have a mixture of conscious and unconscious work. Like, you know, and it's similar to, like, that idea of thinking fast and slow, which is a book my dad told me everything about, but I didn't read, but I need to read. But it's like these two things that need to come together the fast twitch muscle and the slow twitch muscle, the conscious creative impulse, and then the unconscious sort of guiding you without you knowing exactly where it's going or why it's going there.
I feel like you hit this in a really eloquent way of when you were talking about, you know, when you're talking about having a purpose in your work, that can sound like, if you take that to its completion, it sounds like an answer, but and often I've heard like creative work that has an answer is propaganda. And you were saying in Bike Dream, even though you have all of these personal, you know, purposes and things you want to say in them, you, instead of a statement, you said you were asking questions, which is a very weird tension between those two things of, you know, instead, you know, when you're drawing on the page and you're not having a conscious intention, in a way, you're asking yourself a question. And that's, there's some bringing people into that is some of that tension. Does that, you know, does that feel right?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I'm just thinking about some songs that I've loved over the years that all they do is ask questions. For whatever reason, maybe it's because we talked about Hannah Hunt, but I'm specifically thinking about Bob Dylan songs like Queen Jane Approximately, where I think all the lyrics are in a question form. So yeah, I'm just like, yeah, I think questions are hugely important in art. I hadn't heard that quote before about propaganda.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe the opposite of propaganda art is art that's asking questions.
And what do you, just to bring it back in that, do you feel like, what are some of the, you know, like I mentioned before, and I plugged it a few times, In a River is such a good song. And I'm like, I'm hoping there's more in some of this vein because I don't know, does it for me. And I just wonder, what are some of the questions and thing mixed with what you want to say? What are you working? What are you excited about and kind of wrestling with right now?
In a River was kind of inspired by some of my own personal experiences where I felt like this sense of like a, I don't know how else to say it, but like a queer utopia, or like a feeling of just being kind of like being free in a way that I hadn't experienced until I started going to some like queer beaches, which I don't know if any, I don't know, like if you're a queer person, you should go seek those out, because there's something that happens there where you're surrounded by queer people and clothes are optional, and you lose a sense of feeling like judgment and feeling other. And for me, that, you know, that specifically has happened in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which has an incredible queer beach that takes about 20 minutes to get to. And the story of In a River is sort of the story of that queer beach, but I in some ways disguised it, not fully intentionally, but it kind of came out of me more like as river as opposed to beach. Maybe it's just easier to, maybe it just flows better. And right, you know, yeah, that is important in songwriting.
Yeah.
So maybe I wanted to disguise it subconsciously. I didn't want people to know exactly what the song was about, because I think sometimes that's important. It's important for songs not to be super obvious if they're about real things and real experiences. For me, like this idea of a society without judgment, and the idea that that's something that you can find, that was something that I hadn't really encountered until I got to Provincetown. And both the town and the beach, like in different ways, provided me with the sense that I'd never felt before of belonging. And, you know, it's fully a queer town where a majority of people are not straight. I don't want to say like specifically gay, because I think it's more inclusive than that. And, you know, depending on what week you're there, it might be lesbian week, or what they call it, girl splash, or baby dyke. So So yeah, I mean, now I'm really going on about Provincetown, but just to go back to what you were saying, I think for me, I've spent the last 2.5 or 3 years working on a record that I think one of the huge themes of is change. And I don't want to say too much more than that.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's sort of like picking up the strands of belonging, like you hear on In a River, and kind of looking at how belonging and change are linked, and how, like, everybody, I think, wrestles with change. And sometimes to feel, you know, belonging, you have to submit to change. And I think all of us have a degree of fear about change. And I had a, I had some really big life realizations in the last 6 years. And I think that that's really kind of informed my songwriting perspective. And that's what my second album is a lot about, which I don't want to say too much about, but depending on when, depending on when this podcast airs, maybe there'll be a new song for me in the world. But
but you know, I'm super appreciative that you were so forthcoming with all your story, and also in your music that you've shared so much of yourself. And I love hearing the story of that, because, you know, I don't consider myself gay or queer. And I feel that even though I know that that comes from, that song comes from that perspective, it makes total sense to me what you're saying about belonging and non-judgment, because it doesn't feel like it comes from that perspective, but it doesn't feel like a sexual song. It feels very much like a song about feeling comfortable, and, you know,
yeah.
Does that make sense?
I like that. Yeah, I really like that. I think that's huge. And for me, like, like I've said numerous times in this podcast, there's something so fascinating about aiming for universal.
Yeah.
Whether you get there or not.
Well, I appreciate it. I also think it's, you know, I remember growing up and finding out, like, okay, Elton John's gay, and you're thinking, then why is all of his song about women? And I didn't understand all that. And I, you know, in terms of this idea of giving what you didn't get, it seems like, and I know you're more than that, that's not all of who you are, but I think it's just really in terms of that non-judgment and belonging. And I think your music, it democratizing with the way you approach music, it's doing a lot of really interesting, great things. And I'm really glad you took time out. Thanks for spending so much time doing this. And I can't wait to hear the new stuff.
All right. Thank you so much, Andy. Appreciate it.
Grammy Award winning artist Rostam, thank you. You are so much more than that to me. Your music is so personal and has been such a huge deal for me emotionally, and I am so grateful for you putting in the time and energy and heart and spirit to go on your creative journey and to stop and pause for a minute and have this conversation with me. It honestly means the world. Your stuff has accompanied me on my runs, and, you know, while I work, and just all on road trips, and I'm just thrilled to have you on the show and to share your music with these lovely people who are listening. Thank you all for listening. Hope you loved the episode. Go check out Rostam's album June 4th, wherever you get your music. You can go check out the singles, including Forerunner, which is a total banger, in my opinion, as well. And follow Rostam. This guy is the real deal in terms of creativity. Thanks again, Rostam. Appreciate you. Parents, about that virtual event for kids, I'm doing a drawing event with Mightier, the company that makes video games to help kids discover emotional strength. I'm all about that. It will be hands-on We will be talking about how I use drawing, how I've always used drawing ever since I was a kid to calm myself down. Yes, I've been calm before. And I will be teaching them how to draw some of my Invisible Things characters. It's going to be super fun. We did a little activity like this for a small group, and it was a blast. The event is going to be April 14th, 2021, just in a few weeks. It's free, and you don't even need a Mightier account. Go sign up. The spots are limited. Register at mightier.com/pizza. Thanks to Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme music. Thanks to Alex Sugg for our soundtrack. Thanks to Jordan Aaron for editing the show. Content assistance, thank you to the backwards to Sophie Pizza, my wife, and Ryan Appleton, who also helps with sponsors. Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you love this episode. And until we speak next week, you know what to do. Stay pepped up.